and gentlemen, the Roadhouse is proud to welcome the Nine Inch Nails.
Hello there, and welcome to the Last Horror Podcast. My name is Christopher Brown. So when I watched Twin Peaks The Return, the pilot, that first like hour and a half, 2 hour pilot episode, I thought to myself, this is fantastic and it almost certainly will make a great podcast to talk about when it's all done. Mainly because it just felt like a horror movie. It felt very different from Twin Peaks earlier. I'd literally just blitzed season one and two. And Firewalk With Me on the run-up to watching it, because it'd been a long time since I'd watched. Certainly Firewalk With Me. That was probably still in the 90s last time I'd watched that. So I was like, oh, yeah, that sounds a great idea. And then go online, obviously, and then you see the Hot Take Factory spiral into action. There must be 15 to 20 individual Twin Peaks podcasts out there now, doing, as I did with Night Gallery, the episode-to-episode thing, or I suppose with Video Nasties as well, VV Classer, a Video Nasty is an episode, going through each one and kind of analysing and giving thoughts and opinions. There's an Entertainment Weekly one called, I think it's called Twin Peaks Podcast, which is very in-depth, although they are infuriating. They say things like, we were texting each other while watching the show, and you're like, well, you could do that, or you could just watch the fucking show and then text each other, or, you know, make notes if you feel the need to, but not necessarily, get off your phone, particularly if you're being paid to talk about it. And for a British voice, the Diane podcast is very good. Particularly with The Return. It's a difficult, I think for me, Twin Peaks would be a difficult one to episode by episode anyway, because there are episodes, certainly later on in season two, which are just the wheel spinning and nothing happening, and obviously which kind of led to its kind of downfall. And then obviously the last two episodes released this week, last Monday in the UK, Sunday in the US. And the Hot Take Factory went into overdrive to try and understand and explain what this thing was and what it meant, to try and decipher the mystery, which all feels very Mulholland Drive again, in truth. Before, you know, there were podcasts or videos and stuff like that, and people just writing on blogs about it and what their take was and what they felt it meant. And in the end, I think with Mulholland Drive, there was an element of consensus finally brought to what the solution was, even if that solution is probably a little bit more airy than some people would consider. So, spoilers on this episode. It's going to take Twin Peaks as a whole, but with a focus on, obviously, what we've just seen, as they say. And I wasn't going to do it, because there are so many voices out there. What could I add? But, and indeed, I have seen, I think it was on BuzzFeed, someone writing basically what I thought the entire endeavour was actually about. That's just my opinion, and it might not be yours, probably isn't yours, and there's no problem. I'm going to say some stuff that you'll probably be like, mate, shut up. But first thing I'll say is, that's okay too. It's very much a personal thing, I think, this. So, like all this kind of thing, and I'm going to try and at least, first of all, put my own feelings on stuff and where I am on Twin Peaks. I was a little too young, I think, to watch it when it first came out. Although I was pretty obsessed with the idea of it. I think I got into it 93, 94, so it had already finished by then. I think Firewalk With Me came out. And I'd started watching season one. Season one finished on TV, and they didn't put season two on. But I had a mate who had videos, and we kind of got through them all that way. So you would kind of rob a video off and kind of watch it. So I think my what viewing wasn't like a water cooler moment by any stretch, and I kind of viewed it on my own in isolation and didn't kind of try and decipher any of the mysteries by talking to other people. I just kind of chugged along with it. And I think a lot of my experiences probably of Cronenberg and Lynch have all been like that. I'm sure that you know, in the 90s and the early noughties, that was pretty standard stuff to kind of just kind of get your own feelings. Okay. So, in terms of how I feel about the show, I think everything up until Waylon's death is brilliant. I think anything after that is pretty well awful up until the last three episodes of season two, where they try and turn the ship around. I'm not massively enamoured by the last episode of season two, but I think it perfectly tries to kind of set up something more interesting and more different with something which effectively has turned into a bit of a pastiche of itself in the absence of Lynch to kind of hold the tiller when he went off to create other stuff. And I think I had only watched Fire Walk With Me once in the 90s on VHS and thought it was okay, but nothing spectacular. I need to go back and watch it again now. And then I rewatched it just before we started the return, season three. And I thought it was a lot better than I remember, but still so completely different to everything else that I wondered what Lynch wanted to do with it, apart from obviously put, you know, with a TV show about the absence of Laura Palmer becoming a film about the presence of Laura Palmer is a strange one. And obviously, you know, the first 45 minutes are about the absence of Twin Peaks and Dale Cooper to a point, but certainly this Blue Rose idea. And in terms of Lynch, I have watched all Lynch's work, and I think there's pretty much none of it I don't think has value. Even Dune, I think, is certainly technically interesting and brilliantly made, although as incomprehensible as Dune could be. And certainly for a major blockbuster film, as it's meant to be, is not. But it's still fascinating, and I'm a big holder of Dune. I've got a great DVD from America, which has got it's a flipper with the film on and the Alan Smithy terrible TV cut with all the additional exposition in there, which actually makes it more incomprehensible. So that's kind of my feelings on Lynch. I think also the most obvious thing to add is that. Lost Highway, and I watched when I was like 17 at an art house cinema in Liverpool, and it completely changed how I just thought it was amazing. It's one of those films in that formative time of your life when you just your head falls off. And Mulholland Drive again was another cinema view, and is a phenomenal piece of work indeed. Although I always wonder when people say it's the best film of the 21st century, it's like, does that make Lost Highway one of the best films of the 20th? Because Lost Highway is a better movie, but I think with Lost Twin Peaks, The Return, certainly now in Inland Empire, Lost Highway and Mulholland Drive, in comparison to the other films, you know, like Wild at Heart and stuff like that. See, for Wild at Heart, for me, feels like the TV series in terms of the first, you know, Twin Peaks stuff in terms of its ideas and its concepts and its scopes. Although it's all kind of skewed and weird. But the more dreamlike stuff definitely feels like where Lynch has been for the last 20 years now. And my feeling is it benefits from seeing a big old chunk of Lynch. I think one of the things that struck me initially from The Return was that you're watching it going, you really does help to have watched, you know, watch this TV series. Brilliant, yeah, will do. Really helps if you watched 29 episodes beforehand and the movie and to have a grounding in Lynch's other work. It's a big ask. So when they said, not a lot of people who watch this TV show live, I was like, yeah, I'm not that surprised. But apparently it's been a huge thing for streaming, and indeed I've had to pay for a streaming service in the UK to watch it, because it's not on my TV package over here, because I have a different... I'm on Virgin rather than Sky, if that makes any sense to you. But, and that's been a bit frustrating. But, still interesting. But not just that, though. I think even understanding what Twin Peaks is, how it was sold, how it formed and created, is also kind of important to how the return plays out. So when Frost and Lynch pitched Twin Peaks in the late 80s, they initially pitched it as a murder mystery where there is no killer. You don't know the killer. The killer is it isn't about who killed somebody. Now, that would be fine, except, you know, the mystery is the thing that keeps it all together. Now, that would be fine, of course, unless it's completely sold on who killed Laura Palmer. And after 7 episodes, obviously, they just threw another murder in the end and then stopped however long it was, a year. And then, obviously, when they did reveal who Laura Palmer was, the entire thing unraveled, because everything that's held, the fabric of the story is completely pulled away. And without that information, without that knowledge, who killed Laura Palmer, you've got these disparate characters. And a more pivotal question, which I think The Return does try and answer, which is, why does Dale stay? I mean, the TV show kind of says he just wants to stay here. He thinks it's great. He's been there for like a week. But it's understandable that they would want to kind of, obviously, you know, we need more mysteries, we need more ideas. And the mythology around Twin Peaks continues to build out from this world-building concept of, you know, why did Wayland do it? What is in the woods? The history of Twin Peaks, which now there is a big book of, and another book coming from Mark Frost to try and gain the information for people so they can understand what this is. And Fire Walk With Me again is a mystery. A mystery in which Cooper becomes lost to it. And obviously, who killed Laura Palmer is solved again, effectively, in case you missed it the first time. And the ending is of Laura Palmer and Dale Cooper kind of lost to the mystery of it all, stuck within it, never able to leave. And one of the biggies on Fire Walk With Me, obviously, is the fact it was booed at Cannes. Why was it booed at Cannes? Because, in a sense, it wasn't Twin Peaks. It felt... Rewatching it now, it feels kind of a bit of its time. It's quite televisual in some of its shots. It doesn't feel very cinematic, particularly when you consider some of the stuff Lynch was already doing at that time. You know, you look at something like Wild at Heart and the scope of that. Fire Walk With Me does still kind of betray an element of its televisual roots, even though it's obviously its scale is a lot wider and its palette is a lot deeper, and its tone and its themes, let off the leash from a primetime TV, explores some of the very darker elements. Obviously, the big one being the grief and violence at the heart of the story. Because obviously, when you go, you know, if the TV series is about the absence of Laura Palmer and the mystery around that, then the film is about the presence of Laura Palmer and the horror that leads up to it, and lots of people who could have done more but didn't, and that feeds into obviously the grief and absence that sits within the body of Twin Peaks. And then what seems to have happened is 25 years after the show finishes, 25 years after Laura Palmer says, I will see you in another, you know, in 25 years, people kind of decide, yeah, that would be good, wouldn't it? and rumour becomes conjecture and conjecture becomes fact. And Showtime, with its premium TV, paid for television product, decides to give your man, David Lynch and Frost, a sizable sum of cash and tell him, okay, let's do this. So initially they come up with a 9-episode run, and that is converted to an 18-episode run to make it more profitable. Which I think whoever decided to do that probably was more than pleased with the decision, particularly if they've made all this money on these subscriptions, which have been knocking about. I always wonder how much easier David Lynch is to grasp if you see it far more in terms of not what he's trying to say in a story sense, but what he's trying to say directly to the audience. The obvious one being Eraserhead's fear or concern or downright cold despair of fatherhood and the fear that fatherhood brings, told in a very particular way, with quiet moments, dreamlike already in its way it's been put together, but also obviously surrealist. You know, when the Jack Nance character sits down for dinner and they're eating away at those tiny birds on the plates, and it's horribly awkward and sinister and grim. You know, is that actually somebody eating that? Or is that conveying the emotion, the feel, the surrealism of meeting parents and kind of just feeling completely on a limb and alone and isolated while surrounded by people and just wishing for it to go away, to disappear? Like the feeling of just wanting to curl up into a ball and roll out the room, you know? And I think that sits through lots of his work. Lots of his work. You know, and it's not like he's invented this stuff, you know. You know, obviously, you know, Dali's on Shannon Tlu is exactly the same in that kind of storytelling of convey of emotion via visual metaphor. And when we look at the pilot of the episode, what we see online is lots of people saying now, oh, well, that dark presence is obviously Jodie and it's in the box and the box is creating stuff and that's, you know, this dark elements in the world and that's what that's about, and those two people who watch it get killed, and maybe that refers to, you know, the way Bob attacks your man with the green fist, I can't remember the name of, in episode 17, and if they, you know, if they'd had a strong fist they would have got away, but they didn't, which is fine. Or it could be a metaphor for watching this show. It could be about the fact that, you know, it's an exclusive room, which indicates that it's you know, a premium product that not everyone can afford, and the room that makes that is an uncomfortable issue. There is a gatekeeper there, and you might be able to sneak past the gatekeeper in different ways, but ultimately, you know, it's still designed to be for an, you know, an exclusive group, like people who are willing to pay for it. And that box could be the television. It could be the product itself. It could be Twin Peaks, the show. And obviously, you know, in the same way, on Shannon DeLu, when the eyeball is cut with a straight razor, it says, do not believe what you see. This could also be, this is not what you think it will be. It's vicious. It will attack you. You may feel hurt at the end. And also, it's dark. It's considerably darker and different than possibly what you'd hoped it would be. And I think a lot of people are willing to accept that Twin Peaks The Return frequently touches on the concept of being coming back after 25 years to something. You know, and the fact that things do change, but seeing things are still there, and things could have got worse, and some things will have got better. And that you can't just press a play button and it all starts again, because everything, including the audience, has changed. But I think they mainly, from what I've read, and I'm not saying I've read everything on the internet, but what I've read from online tends to be that people are only really accepting that as just a standard thing is when the fourth wall is broken, specifically when actors talk about other actors. So you have that incredible Wally Brando conversation early on when Michael Cera is dressed like Marlon Brando, does a kind of a mystical kind of let the road roll up to your wheels kind of chat, and he's obviously incredibly in tune and charismatic with the road and his surroundings and his place in the world, and talks about obviously the missing character of the sheriff of Harry Truman, who wasn't there and is notable in his absence, certainly early doors, played by Michael Opkin, and a kind of a war break in terms of kind of saying, you know, you are missed in this return. Then obviously, more importantly, probably, is the those scenes with the log lady, which are still incredibly powerful. Because obviously Kathleen Coulson died pretty soon after filming. It appears to have been shot probably by Lynch in her living room with, you know, very beautifully lit and her pretty much face camera kind of delivering these very heartfelt lines. And obviously Lynch and Coulson were friends. And that is very much a scene. And a few times of his scene kind of, you know, somebody giving somebody a pivotal role in the story and acknowledging a friendship, both that in real life and obviously in the fictional world, but predominantly it feels in real life that that is ending due to illness. And it's really touching. And it's really touching because you don't normally see something quite so beautiful and heartfelt and honest and emotionally honest as that on telly, on normal in telly. But what I don't think people were too keen on or were too willing to kind of grasp were that there were a lot more fourth wall breaks in terms of metaphor in the story. Until probably 17 and 18 basically just stares the camera when, listen, lads, this is actually, this entire series is actually about returning and nostalgia and things not being what they were. And also repetition. The Morpheus strip, which is seen in episode 17, that this cannot be what you want it to be because the world has changed and the characters have changed. But at the start, when it was first sold, that's probably not true. When Showtime started releasing these images, it was sold as, lads, we are going back to Twin Peaks. We are actually going to do this and it actually is going to look like that. And the characters were all dressed as they were 25 years ago, but greyer hair, more lines, still looking like all of them looking cool as fuck, but you know, really, really amazingly, and all seemingly delighted that they were back. Except not quite how you would imagine it would be. And I think, and as that series went on, people became more and more concerned, you know, where is Twin Peaks? You know, why are we all spending humongous amounts of time in Vegas, or you know, why is Cooper still Dougie? You know, where's Audrey? All the way through, and then episode 16 comes along, and you go, we're not going to find out. We're all about what's going on with Audrey, and I think that in itself is really interesting. Because they felt at that point a real ownership over what was going on. And 17 and 18 played heavily on the concept of that ownership. And I'll get to my feelings on that generally in the end. That the return probably, in fact, was a complete, almost strange, surreal remake of all of Twin Peaks. Okay, so let's talk about what happened in those last two episodes, because I think it's important. So episode 17 effectively becomes similar to... Actually, no, that's not. Let's actually do the entire thing, right? This is my theory on Twin Peaks. Welcome to Hot Take 792. Right. So, if the first 14 episodes of Twin Peaks is the delayed gratification of understanding what is going on, the slowness and the deliberate drive towards who killed Laura Palmer and the payoff of that in the end, then that is Dougie. That is effectively the Dougie character. That journey of him, of just waiting for him to be cooped, for that mystery or that issue or that narrative problem to be solved, is effectively a rerun of Who Killed Laura Palmer from a narrative point of view. The audience is sitting there going through here, there, everywhere, all this stuff, all these sideline stories, which a lot of which, in truth, go nowhere. There are articles that just go bang, 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 plot point, plot point, plot point, 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 plot point, and basically underline and say, all these are useless in this story. But the journey is obviously more important than that. And how those stories and those threads make you feel are way more important than that. Apart from the fact that Twin Peaks is still bad. It is gone bad. There is all sorts of mess. And people are still trying to go through their lives. They're still trying to exist. But a lot of those plot points are... effectively, particularly when you go to things like the Roadhouse and stuff like that, are that the world of Twin Peaks is still on the top level, picket fence and lovely and blue velvet, and on the bottom level, deeply troubling, crazy people, awful, just like blue velvet. And a lot of those stories do meander and then stop. Horn the Younger, effectively... goes through a lot of journey, does some terrible things, seemingly for little reason, and then is effectively just wiped out by Dark Coop. But the journey's the thing, and at the heart of it is basically watching and waiting the slow and steady growth of Dougie to finally just flick. And in the same way in Twin Peaks season 2, effectively, it just gets solved. Bang. Dougie just puts himself into the electricity supply and bang, we got Coop back after a short off-screen period in hospital. What we get then is a condensation of what happens afterwards, season 2, which is jokey metaphors, straight, you know, characters added to the storyline, you know, storyline with a destiny that we haven't journeyed with in any particularly meaningful way, apart from the fact that there's a connection to the fireman in his overseeing arch-like world, and is far more controlling of the situation than it initially would appear. And we get some boss level fight, and where Bob is a black ball that's punched in the face with super hand, and the office of the sheriff, Truman's office, is so big and so wide and so huge, so it can fit all these auxiliary characters in, like the end of a theatrical play, just so they're all there. So we've all got closure on everything, and we can just wrap all this shit up right now. And then Cooper's face is superimposed over the story, and he declares it all potentially to be a dream. And I think a lot of people's heads start to fall off at that point, because you're a bit, you know, I'd say, whoa, son, hang on, are you saying all of Twin Peaks is a dream? Oh, is what's coming next like real? And that is, I think a lot of people freaked out because that is it's an all a dream style ending, which would be insane. So no, he hasn't done that. Behave yourselves. Can we accept that the powers of Frost and Lynch would not make it all a dream? But we are talking about interdimensionals. We are talking about planes of experience. And we are talking about the fact that Coop, throughout the show, has been able to to understand the world around him more through a dreamlike structure. For me, that is quintessentially what happens at the last bit of season two. It's just, you know, you can accept this however you want to accept this. It's fan service, basically. It's absurd. It's ridiculous. And it's potentially what people were expecting the Return of Twin Peaks to basically be. Fuck tons of, like, characters swirling around and a resolution of sorts, no matter how ridiculous that would be. And why is that ending so ridiculous? It's the concept that Bob, who, bear in mind, was created as a happy accident on set, when he was kind of seen in the corner of a shot and kind of like, ooh, that's interesting and scary, is some kind of personification of evil. And therefore, and if you're feeding into the themes of good, as in a good coup, and a bad, as in a bad coup, then that concept, that idea, is preposterous, that good at the end of it should overcome evil, because we are all complicated beings, we're all complicated people. We're more to it than that. The world is dark with moments of light, because that's the world. And, you know, we create pockets of niceness and greatness, but on its own out there, without the things that we create around ourselves, we are unable to survive. And that is a key point. So good cannot try, but you know, you can't gentrify the world. You can't make everything perfect. Coop isn't a god, and neither is the fireman, in truth. He's just some overseer. There's a suggestion of alien activity. There's a suggestion that Bob was created and Judy was given more power from a cataclysmic event in episode 8, in that incredible episode, which is like none of the rest of the show, which actually has a pretty standard narrative. I mean, a lot of this, I think, is narratively not that complicated, but, you know, some terrible trauma's happened, and that doesn't go away. And that is something that, you know, you've wanted, you know, if the Return of Twin Peaks is an attempt to get closure, to get Coop out that red room, to suddenly have a mystery that is who killed Laura Palmer, to change to can we save Laura Palmer, then that's an acknowledgement that the world isn't particularly the way it is, that you can't put a neat bow and stuff. And that's a powerful, although potentially unpleasant, narrative tool. And then we get, obviously, the attempt to save Laura. The fact that Laura effectively may be plucked out of existence, which would mean that the world of Twin Peaks has changed substantially. You know, you could have had a montage of, you know, everyone going about their Twin Peaksy day, but Laura's there. But that wouldn't obviously unwrite all the terrible stuff that had happened before. And then obviously everything changed in episode 18. Everything flips. We get a Mulholland Drive to last 25 minutes. We get the flip in the jail cell in Lost Highway, where the narrative potentially is the same, but the characters have changed substantially. Is Diane saved? Is she gone? Has Cooper managed to somehow be able to rewrite or remove the terrible trauma that that part of himself created that night when he raped Diane? I find a lot of the use of sexual violence, incidentally, a little bit... you know, there are two major cataclysmic, allegedly off-screen rapes that are discussed in the film, in the TV show. One is Diane's and one is Audrey's. And they're not discussed properly in any meaningful way. Apart from this sex scene where she covers Dale's face. And that is also true. Well, it's not true in terms of the mystery of Laura Palmer. It's kind of, you know, something terrible's going on, and Waylon's going way further than just, you know, being awful and violent. It's really only properly discussed in terms of Fire Walk With Me, I think. And that Fire Walk With Me is a very different narrative story. And I think episode 18, with the link with Jeffries, the Bowie character, who now is reduced to sliding in a kettle, that's kind of, that thing for me fits in together with that the narrative is that kind of jump towards a more modern version of Lynch, which is all, you know, it's all in there already, you know, these dark forces, these, you know, the woodsmen and all that kind of stuff. But there is a shift. Now, for me, that last episode is like Fire Walk With Me. It is a kind of complete uptip of what we're actually talking about, and kind of saying, you know, you've wanted, you know, a lot of people thinking Twin Peaks and they think coffee and cherry pie and a little bit of random mysticism thrown in there. But Lynch sees Twin Peaks now as the Fire Walk With Me version. Strange cases to kind of lighten the mood, but then at the heart of it, trauma, grief, violence. You know, you can write Sarah Palmer two different ways from what that is. The internal darkness that's in Sarah can be just a narrative device. Oh, Judy's in Sarah now. That's fine. That's part of that story told, and that makes sense. And when she smashes the picture, she is, you know, sending her to a different dimension, and that kind of narrative plugs into sockets to kind of keep this fucker on the road, that it all fits together. Or you can talk about the fact that Sarah Palmer is locked in grief on her own. It's hollowed her out. She lives, you know, why is she sitting there on her own drinking, watching, or not really paying attention to a loop of a boxing match, of a vision of violence that is socially acceptable in our age? Why is she sitting there just watching the same bit of violence again and again and again and feeding it in? And is not Sarah Palmer the absolute definition of someone who's been consumed by grief? A woman who lost her husband, but also lost everything he was about. You know, the man who created all this around her, who helped build the family with her, you know, destroyed it so absolutely. Of the absence of Sarah, of Laura Palmer, and a smashing of that image is as much an anger phase at the victim, that she is still part of this thing that's killing her. And the fact, you know, Now you can, and again, you can say that scene in the bar where she rips out that guy's throat. That can be, well, that's not her fault. That's just a demon inside her, you know. Or it can be that she has been changed so absolutely by the trauma and the grief that's happened to her that she is 100% something different. So when a man makes violent sexual approaches on her, she is completely changed. And she is not what that man would assume that woman would be. In fact, she is in her own strip of that figure of eight, that infinity symbol that Jeffrey shows, locked within it, as is Wayland, who still, to this day, is in the Red Room, desperately trying to get somebody to save her, save Laura Palmer. Or Laura Palmer herself, who is frozen in time still, able to be plucked out from a moment, however impossible that might be. And so there's journey and there's travel and there's a joke about the fact that she's committed violence against a man, potentially. And then that final moment, what year is this? Where are we? Almost as a question. Well, we know where we are. We're on the streets. Now, a lot of people are talking about, you know, is this breaking? Have they arrived in our world? Well, no, they haven't arrived in our world because our world has a TV program called Twin Peaks on it. You know, Kyle MacLachlan isn't Richard. They are in a version of a different world that things have changed. And you can't go back. You can't change stuff. That the grief and trauma will be there. And Cooper, for whatever reason, for some concept that this is a good and evil versus battle, potentially, takes Laura Palmer, who isn't Laura Palmer, to the Palmer House, which is not the Palmer House anymore. But rather nicely and politely gives a cameo to the owner of the house, which is, I think is why a lot of people are like, well, this is the real world. But it is a version of a different world. I think that's definitely true. And Palmer screams, and she screams like she does when Cooper tries to make everything okay with her the first time around by trying to get her out the Red Room, and she turns to him and she screams and the lights go out, and the best thing we can see there is they're in the Red Room and she's whispering secrets into his ear, which could or could not be the you know where they are now, and that's it, and that's the end of Twin Peaks. See you at the curtain call. There is no curtain call for this moment. We are done. The curtain call is after the show, after the story. Everyone takes their bow. And I think that's really interesting as well, because if that last episode is like a kind of rerun of some of the themes of Fire Walk With Me, a more realistic version of trying to understand and get a grip on the nature of violence and the concept of the viciousness of the world, but unable to actually kind of achieve it. You know, you can't make the world better. And the reality is, for majority of characters in that show, nothing really changes. Not for the ones that are still existing. You got Big Ed and Norma, it being the biggie of a change in the narrative, that kind of, you actually, yeah, it is good. They have received what they want. Jacoby is still, you know, in the 90s, he was exploiting people through psychology. And now he's kind of some kind of InfoWars guy who's exploiting people through a you know, his own political bullshit, basically, just so he can sell gold shovels. He hasn't changed. And a lot, you know, a lot of those characters in the sheriff's department haven't really changed either. You could argue the two lads who they've kind of grown up in their lives, but that, you know, there's nothing major happened there. And then there's the new characters who have kind of are still in the same cycles of life that they were before. And then you've got the key ones, the ones that everyone always thinks about. Audrey, Coop, and Laura Palmer. Well, Audrey, we still don't know. She might as well have still been exploded in that bank vault. Coop is still locked in his attempts to try and save Laura Palmer. And Laura Palmer is still lost to the world. Invisible, gone, and not real. So the journey of the return kind of almost says to us, in 25 years, you know, we've respected this as the ending, and we're going to kind of still respect it as the ending. This is a third act memorandum, which doesn't give you the closure you need, because the lack of closure in the mystery is part of what made that complete mystery, as was the box set called, complete, you know, that it was that thing, that physical element. So what does that mean? Or indeed, even if you think I've just took shite for that bit. Well, your response is the answer. Your response to that mystery is the answer. I know it's very tempting to run onto AV Club and read all this stuff or listen to this and kind of say, well, that is definitely what is right. But I would urge you not to do that. I'd urge you to do what I used to do, what we all did in the 90s and the 80s and 70s and before the fucking internet kind of had, you know, definitive absolutes of what's right and wrong in art and in culture and politics, and everyone's got their hot take machine in the back, and just experience it for yourself and kind of, you know, how that made you feel. That's probably good enough. I don't think Twin Peaks really is a mystery that can be solved, or indeed ever was really the aim to be solved. You can always add more to the mystery, but in the end, they're far more than willing to keep it going, to keep it within itself, to keep the story kind of existing in its own mysterious form. Because when you remove that, when you take away, when you explain the magic trick, you're just left with how to do a magic trick and no more any magic. My own feeling when it finished was kind of a little depressed, probably a little sad, mainly because it had finished, if I'm being honest. Just like, oh, that is done. That is completely done. And an acceptance, I suppose, that, you know, it has just finished in a kind of a slightly bleak way. And that kind of made me feel a little, I just kind of wish that maybe a more, it hadn't been quite so black and dark in those closing moments. And I'm glad that he kind of superimposed, you know, as the credits went up, we see them still in that red room, with Laura Palmer whispering her secrets into his ear. So at least we can still see of Coop still understanding the mysteries more and more. Interestingly enough, this talk of time wrapping in on itself, there's a film, a British film that came out, I think it's coming out on DVD and Blu-ray like this week, and it's got, the liner notes have a piece written by Adam Scoville, who I did a chat with about folk horror and his folk horror book. So definitely recommend getting the Blu-ray if you like the film. It is called The Ghoul, and it's directed by a guy called Gareth Tunley, and it's written by him as well, and it is a very interesting, intriguing, low-budget British movie, and it follows a lot of these themes in terms of lack of escape, being locked in a moment, and very, you know, contained within itself of the fact that, you know, not all mysteries need solutions. So I do kind of wonder about Twin Peaks and in terms of, you know, that nostalgia, that feeling you got when you saw those pictures from an Entertainment Weekly of the characters all like kind of looking exactly the same but a bit different, and David Lynch kind of standing there proud as punch, shock of white hair, and kind of what does that, you know, Twin Peaks by its nature is very different for all different characters, for all different people's viewpoints, you know, as, and the one of the striking things when I was watching episode 18 was how wildly different it was to the pilot of the original series, and how completely this story, as it's grown and morphed and the years have come onto it, how it's completely altered itself and its body and its physicality, and how important that is to itself, that as it grew, it morphed into something. And so that nostalgia is impossible. And there is a part of me that thinks this entire series has been basically Frost and Lynch going, this is a fantastic opportunity, we can't turn this down. But the challenges of creating something that potentially never existed in the first place and kind of talk to people in completely different ways are impossible. So let's possibly just talk about that as an overarching theme. And anyway, nostalgia isn't what it used to be. Although apparently, according to a report this week, it's good for the soul. You feel better when you go back to the beach or you go back to places of your childhood. It lowers the blood pressure and kind of makes you feel a bit better. So if you're a bit anxious and you haven't got the memories of Laura Palmer to contend with and the traumas of that, then go to somewhere that maybe you remember beautifully and nostalgically, and you might get over some of the grief of the fact that this incredible run of television has sadly come to an end. There you go. Thank you very much for listening. I hope that you enjoyed that. Also, thank you to Stuart, who's at @_overfed on Twitter, who I think we've been following each other for a very long time, who said he enjoyed been enjoying this series as well as the others that I've been doing. And thank you to Wolf as well, who again is a long-time listener, who are both very happy. Bought me a coffee using the buy me a coffee button on the website, and if you want to do that, that would be nice. But thank you very much to them and to doing it for well when I'm not being putting stuff out. So I suppose I need to at least mention this as in the last few episodes. I am very aware that I am doing what is the quintessential thing that happens when websites or podcasts, I should say, or blogs are about to close, are about to wrap things up or just not come back on. they say, okay, we're going to do this episode on Wednesday, and then it doesn't happen. And then they come back 2 weeks later and say, ah, well, we didn't do that episode because, oh, you know, life. So we're going to do a different episode now, and this is it, and it's just us rambling. Okay. And then it goes quiet again for a bit, and then they do stuff more and more sporadically, and then it just stops. And they might not even put one out saying, sorry, lads, I can't do this anymore for whatever reason. So what's been happening is that I have been incredibly busy with work. So I work weird hours. Well, not weird hours, but I work very long hours Monday to Thursday. I have like a short day on Friday, and which I spend in the afternoon with my wife, and we do things together on that Friday afternoon. And then traditionally, Saturday morning, while she's still asleep and my insomnia is terrible, is podcast time, as it is today, because I woke up at 7 and went, yeah, let's get this done. Because I really wanted to do this, and Laura was a big push for me to get one out about Twin Peaks. And I haven't been awake in the morning on the Saturday mornings. I've been sleeping because I've been knackered, or I've been getting up and doing 2 or 3 hours of work Saturday morning while she's been asleep. And indeed, last weekend I did work on Saturday, work on Sunday. Friday afternoon, Saturday and Sunday, and then went to work on Monday. And then, yeah, I need some time just to watch football and watch baseball and maybe try and get a horror film in or go to the pictures, you know, go and see Detroit I'm not at the opportunity. I want to go see Mother this weekend. I don't think I'm going to get the chance to do that. Not that fussed about it, but I'll give it a go probably. But I don't know if I'll go with pictures. I might just watch it on my own at home. I know the reviews have been really up and down, but it's the kind of thing I'll probably benefit from just watching on Dark Knight on my own and me room with me. Projector on. Anyway, so that's kind of where that is. So this isn't closing, it's just gonna be potentially a little bit more sporadic for a bit longer. I mean, you know, we're getting to October, it'd be really good to get some good stuff out in October. I know I said I'd do something about BBFC censorship. It's just so much research. It's far more likely you're going to get me just rambling for 45 minutes about things I've been thinking about. But we'll see. And I'm pretty sure you're probably aware that this is a far rougher edit than some of the other ones that I do. And indeed, normally I would edit this bit down to make it more, you know, quick and easy, not make going and the fingers. But I've not done that there, and I've not done it on the actual show as well. So I'm sorry if you're finding it hard to get through. If it is like just terrible, let me know. And next time I do it, I will make, you know, it's not that much longer. It's just another hour. And, I haven't got time, the patience currently, but I will endeavor to at least make more breakpoints and make it easier. There's ways around it, which I used to do when I was doing Night Gallery. So I might revert to doing it like that. And then kind of, it would be a lot quicker and easier to do. Okay. Anyway. Right. So there's that. What else? Okay. Yeah. So you want to get hold of me? Always happy to talk. I'm not on Twitter a lot at the moment, but I am there lurking. So if I just heart your tweets, I'm not being a dick. I'm just kind of probably in the middle of something. And I'm during the week, you know, you can probably catch me in the evening or in the like really early morning, but probably not much else online. And that's at @orange_monkey, or you can email me. Again, I will get around to replying you, but it's going to take a while. It's christopher@thelasthorrorpodcast.com, or go to the website, and there is loads of content on there. Promise you, that you can have a look at. Anyway, I am not going to say what I'm going to do next, and I'm not going to say when it is. But until then, and it will happen, take care, and I'll speak to you soon. Goodbye.
Tonight, an ABC premiere presentation.
She's dead. Wrapped in plastic.
Look, you guys, please, what did I do? What's going on?
Entering the town of Twin Peaks.
FBI. Right.
Something troubling you, Bobby, you want to tell us about?
Oh, God.
You think
I killed her?
There it is. Oh my God, here it is.
Twin Peaks, next.
Sheriff, we got a lot to talk about.